Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
podcast while walking. I'm just going to cover, in this case, a trip into Sydney, and I've been podcasting for about, I think about 20, or probably 10 minutes, and I had experimented with a new method of affixing my microphone, which would possibly be less noisy, but unfortunately it proved out to be a complete waste of time. I had actually connected to it to the zip fastener of my jacket, because it's actually beginning to be a bit cold here at night, about 12 degrees here in Sydney. Up here in Sydney, it's 12 degrees, but it actually gets quite nippy. I think it's there. But it fell off, and I was wondering what this dangling thing I was feeling as I was walking around the place, and it was the actual microphone. So it's the microphone's back in a more traditional position. It might be a bit rustly as we're going along. And I want to cover some key things of about the founding of Australia. So this is boring stuff. This is actually quite fascinating. And this is stuff that I've picked up from going to the Museum of Sydney. There's a little bit of a story behind that. And so it was a day in Sydney, sort of an add-on from going into Sydney to put my daughter on a bus. And then you're in Sydney, or it's like to spend the rest of the day there and then come back. This is with my wife and my youngest son. I've got six children, and my youngest son's 12, so there's a little bit of a story there. And this particular museum is the Museum of Sydney, and it is an odd museum. It is odd in that it's not in the family of museums, the big museums. It's a small museum held by Sydney. So there's a few museums in there. It's sort of like, if you imagine the museums getting together, forgetting to do this particular museum, and its focus is on the founding of Sydney and a bit of town planning and some focuses on Sydney life. And in this stuff I'll do a real focus on some of the interesting aspects that I picked up this time. Now, we'll go into it in that I'm walking around the park. There's a sort of village park here, sort of an extended oval carrying three kilogram weights, and slowly building up my muscles with it. So I've got so I'll just focus on that for a short while before I go back into Australian history. So it's sort of like a mix, so you're having a feel of what it's like to be an Australian, I suppose. And then we'll go back into some really fascinating aspects. And when I say fascinating, that's just unbelievable. You are just not going to believe it. So going back, for me there's the cognitive rebuild, which I have to do, and it's sort of like a huge race, but it feels to me like one of these ultra-marathon races. It's unlike, a classic. I've run marathons before. It's unlike a marathon where it's got an end. It doesn't finish, and you sort of get fitter as you run. Oh, I don't know, it's just this long, long slog. And one of the slogs is become fitter and stronger and get your weight down to the prescribed weight, increase your cognitive ability, and that, my friend, is a huge slug. You go back onto computers and you just see your cognitive ability appearing to stay absolutely dead, die the same, and inadequate, unfortunately. And for weight, it's a fairly simple equation. you have to lose so many grams a day. I thought I was doing well on 20, but you can easily lose 5 times that much. And basically, you start off with shaking yourself out, getting a bit of control on portion sizes, watching that is. So it's food in versus expenditure, energy expenditure. So essentially, if you are overweight, you have to pick up your energy expenditure, raise it a little bit higher than your food intake, and watch it there. And you know, I don't know, I have have 1 or 2 sugary drinks I shouldn't have. Still tend to focus on it, get the food intake down. I'm just cruising down, and then the activity, basically to do the activity, you've got to get fit, and there's sort of time management associated with it and skills associated with it. And you wouldn't think so. You think, look, an exercise bike, any idiot can do it. But as I get a bit of advice and training, it's all about slowly ramping your heart rate up, getting 5 to 10 minutes at the burn speed, and then slowly ramping it down. So at the moment, it's I take 15 minutes to slowly get it up to the level, and then there's 5 minutes I can last at a bit of a push, and then 5 minutes to is it 5? I'm just trying to think. 25? Yeah, 5 minutes to get down. And it's slightly different. You don't feel so exhausted after it if you do it properly, even that type of stuff. And then walking, rather than just very long walks, I'm now doing it carrying 2-3 kilogram weights around the place. Now, I'll get into that's the sort of the story about what's happening and why you're going to hear someone breathing a bit hard and speaking, and you'll hear the noises at the background. Now let's get into the real nitty-gritty. So this museum, there's a series of museums in that area, is just behind Circular Quay. So Circular Quay is a really famous bit of Australia. It's on one side, you've got the Opera House, on the other side, you've got the Sydney Harbour Bridge, and you've got Harbourside. Sometimes there's seals out there. There's sort of, there's always some activity there. I think Sydney is slowly coming along. There's more malls and, not malls, you know, pedestrian precincts and trams. So it's slowly eking its way forward. It's got a large amount of parklands and things like that. And so there are these museums here. And I suppose the very first thing I want to say, I'll try and put this in order. So I've been to this museum before. I don't know whether it's the cognitive ability to go up or the fact that I'm training cognitive stuff. I'm saying slightly different things. And so there's probably 11 meters long, 1 meter wide, glass cabinet which you walk around, which has the miniaturized First Fleet. So the First Fleet is the first group of colonist people coming from Britain to live in Australia, and they landed on Sydney Cove in Port Jackson, which is Sydney Harbour, coming through the Heads, and they arrived in 1788. So in 1776, there was the American Revolution, and with that, there was this sudden shutdown of where to put convicts, and use of a massive British Navy. And what happened is that the convicts were put in overflowing and stored in hulks. That is old ships. So it's the perfect way. You've got prisoners, you just put them in a ship, and you can therefore, so you, before you sink a ship or whatever it is, when it's no longer seaworthy, let's try and tell you about wooden ships. So they're all wooden ships at this time, and a ship has a lifetime. So it's built, and then it goes to sea, and it reaches the peak naval operation about 3 years in. So that's basically the wood seasons at sea, adjusts at sea, so there's a ship ship's carpenter there, and there's all the faults get run out of it after 3 years. Then it's got about 3 to 10 years when it's suitable for the British Navy. Then it gets rebuilt and repurposed over and over again. So it goes back into the merchant fleet, and eventually, well, the ships were eventually just sinking at sea. But they had this period of time. And so the British Navy is producing a huge number of ships. And so if you have ships like this, you have a... And at the very end, when they're no longer seaworthy, they were prisons. So there were things known as hulks. And then the hulks, after they've been used, would be recycled. This, you know, fantastic recycling. And even the rope was recycled. Everything was recycled. But it had this whole economy of producing ships. And this is important, that when the British... decided that they would go out to Australia, they basically wrote reports. You know, it was a real public service thing, and then they basically chartered merchant vessels. That is to say, if you had a school, but so basically it was 1,300 people. But essentially, it would be equivalent to taking a whole high school, which is about 1,000 people in Australia, if you've got these fairly large high schools, and putting them on a bus. And, you know, you've got to take the whole high school. And now, you can imagine 11 ships taking over 1,300 people. So rather than a bus, the ships were like the length of 2.5 buses length, three buses length. So that's a ship and supplies to go in. So there were 11 ships, of those 11 ships, 9 were just hired and 2 were from the British Navy. The equivalent warfare ships. And 10 of them were almost, they look fairly similar to each other. Because they're sort of the, So there's, in terms of overall length, they're sort of 3 bus lengths long. Not longer than that. Each individual ship. And these ships, merchant ships, but that means they're no longer considered fit for use by the British Navy, and they are fairly stable, but take cargo, and so they'll go on long cargo journeys. As they get worse and worse, they start to do smaller and smaller trips. And so the idea was that they hired these 11 ships. So there's actually only 11. So they hired 9 ships, and then there were 2 ships. Basically, they came with 2 permanent ships and 9 ships. And they were cargo ships, cargo and freighters. And after they dispersed, of those nine ships went north to China and to Indonesia to trade, and they would go take a bit of I suppose freight, and essentially they would go into a port. They might have a bit of advance warning about what they're doing, but they would go up and they would say, well, this port has this much to be shipped there, and you'd go in. It's sort of like they didn't have a World Wide Web, and so people would be producing these things, and they'd know what they wanted. They'd have a, say, a trade contract, and they'd know that so many ships would turn up, and they'd just, the cargo would wait there for the number of ships to come along. It's a sort of communication across there. So of these 11 ships, 10 were almost identical, these three commercial buses along. And one of those was a command troop ship. It wasn't a command troop ship, one was a military supply ship. And then there was another ship which was only 1.5 buses long. It was much smaller, and of course, with the my cognitive improvement, I'd miss this. That there were obviously, this is a simple thing. There's how many ships? There's 11 ships. For some reason, I was 11, and I thought there was two naval ships. So I bumped that up to 13. But there's only there's nine freight ships, and two military ones. And so this took a while. And then this overall, being able to take information in, the supply was a really small ship. And the idea is that it was small, so it could be much faster. And its job was to be faster. And so if there was trouble, its aim was part of the British way of making naval convoys. They would have very light, faster ships which could go out and scout for problems and scout around places, and then it would go out, and then you got the heavier ship which was be able to defend the fleet. So this is absolutely minimal. But the HMS Supply was the flagship. This is the command ship, and it would go forward and scout and do various things. And so when the colony was established, it went back to South Africa, picked up supplies and came back with supplies. And it was the HMS Supply. It was a supply ship, and it established the city of Sydney, because the Lord who authorised it was called Sydney. So that's why it's called Sydney. But then when Sydney was founded, a few months afterwards, the supply went to Cape Hope, got some more supplies to South Africa, came back, and then they went to Norfolk Island and founded another colony called Sydney. So there was, Sydney started off with two Sydneys. So of that, there was under 900, there's a feral cat. I hate them. So, coming along. You see these mogs? I don't know. Oh, it's a scary thing. Let's have a look. If it's a real feral one, you'll be able to tell. Sorry, I'm just walking around the place. So, the big thing is that this, I didn't understand about this supply. I didn't know that the supply then got shipwrecked off Norfolk Island. And again, they were all carrying some pretty unusual orders. Now, I've memorised some war facts that the fleet came through the heads of Sydney. So they went to Port Botany, which was the Admiralty said go to Port Botany. no water there, and then the supply went up, hunted up Port Jackson, that area around there, and then the fleet went through the heads of Sydney. Now there was a storm season, and there was some big storms, and the fleet nearly all sank. That small little thing from one part of Sydney, from outside the airport, so many kilometres around, through the heads of Sydney, they nearly all sank. They came before dawn. So the bit I was able to pick up this thing is a bit more knowledge about the supply. There's some new information which I didn't realise. It sort of come to pass because they've got the drawings of not the top. Now the important thing is that everyone used to draw everything, draw pictures to send back home, and the military and the navy used to draw pictures all the time because it was part of military intelligence. It is true that, say, for infantry, Australian infantry, when they hit the ground, or used to hit the ground in the 80s and 70s, they'd have a small pad and they would draw, physically draw what's in front of them, which is sort of getting back to the British. And so this person who wasn't high up in the Navy drew what was happening in the first instance on first contact with the Aboriginals. And the Aboriginals really didn't know what to make of the English people coming in. And so they came and they began dancing with, this is true, dancing with the first people. And there's all these pictures of these Aboriginals actually dancing with first people of the first fleet. And they had the sketchbooks of this happening. And sort of this is sort of missed. It's sort of like this, this is weird coming across, but it's also very interesting. Now, the other thing is that the Aboriginals couldn't work out what these people are because they had no clothes. Aboriginals had no clothes. And so they couldn't work out that the clothes were separate from the people. And because the clothes covered their genitals and stuff like that, they couldn't work out whether the actual people were, this new stuff, they couldn't work out whether they were completely alien or were they men, were they, male or female. They thought they were all female. And so one of the officers, they kept on saying, please take down your pants. We want you to take down your pants to see what's there. They didn't know. And this officer then got one of the lower ranked sailors to take down his pants, and there was all this exclamation, oh, they're people. They had to see that. So that's a really important aspect of it. And with this, there was the the whiff of cross-cutting. Now, cross-cutting really hit the second fleet, but it's the first fleet was a whiff of cross-cutting, and they really, when they said, who wants to be in this first fleet, they couldn't get any professional naval officers there, so they got this retired naval officer, Arthur Phillip, to man it. So he's fairly old, but being old, he's very wise, and sort of fairly undistinguished career, but sort of avoided battles, very conciliatory person. So he's not the a fantasy person. So there were indeed fantasy people there in the colony, but he himself was a rational, he wasn't a fantasist. However, there were indeed fantasists. So a lot of people, a lot of the officers were not, he was a genuine officer, but a lot of the other officers were what, not what you would call genuine officers, i.e. that they had a bit of a chequered career and wound up mostly in British Army, British Navy recruiting. Because you've got a huge Navy, and the major thing is that you had to have recruiting, so you had to have people who were interested in marketing it. And so you've got a number of people, sort of actually two-thirds of people, and a number of people who had jobs in recruiting. So they wound up here, sort of this big odd podge of people. Now, the important thing that I didn't realise is that Arthur Phillip had lost one of his front teeth. And so he didn't have a complete set of teeth. But neither did the Aboriginals. All the Aboriginals were missing a front tooth. Now, the story was that they had an adult initiation ceremony in that tribe of removing a front tooth. And when I heard that, this is a really important piece of information. And that sent a chill down my spine. I'll give you a story why it sent a chill down my spine. But the Aboriginals then were trying to work out, was really struggling to work out what was going on. What were these strange people? And there were certain things like in that they were in the tall ships. There were sailors up the rigging, and this bloody cat here. What the heck is this doing? The second time around, this cat's in the same area. It's up to no good. So it's not a feral cat. It's a mog. I hate them. Okay, sorry. So one of the things the Aboriginals saw when they saw people up, climbing up the tree, up the rigging, they didn't quite understand what it was, and they believed that these people were possums. So they thought that some of the people were spirits, and some of the people, sailors up the top, were possum people. Because that's how people could climb up the ropes and stuff like that, to get up the sails. Because you didn't have automation, you didn't have motors, and you did have sort of ropes you could pull, but in general, for it to operate, essentially you had to have people who would climb up. So that was there, and you had the crow's nest, the people way up the top of a ship, which gave them a huge visibility. Because Arthur Phillip had the Aboriginal sign, they were automatically put at ease and knew that he was the commander. And because he was he wasn't full of his own stories or other stories like that. He was actually tuned in, and they actually began to talk and negotiate with him. And this is because they were reading the signs. So as this comes through, there's a greater knowledge of, I suppose, how the Aboriginals saw it. Now, I'll just say a small story to say where this really then gave a huge sort of shock to me coming back. This goes back to the probably 50s, 60s. So a large section of the Pacific was so remote and so, so open to exploitation that the United Nations divided it up and gave it to different countries to organise protection. Now, the areas of the Pacific given to the United States, which is the Solomon Islands, or different things, Federation of Polynesia, large areas of that, the United States have really sort of misinterpreted it, and they've sort of made them sign treaties that the US has treated it as their own territory in terms of military control. I've got Kiribati, several areas between Guam and, you know, stretching across pretty much the area of the United States, but, you know, Pacific Ocean with little atolls on it and little peoples. Probably you'll be stretching at the total population of all these countries as around under 100,000. So there's a few people there. But Australia was given the protectorate of Papua New Guinea and there was West Yirrkala. Now, West, they had a fixed election, a fake election. West Yirrkala, and they voted that they would go off to Indonesia, whereas the area under the Australian protectorate, that was under the Dutch protectorate, the Australian area, which was Papua New Guinea, they worked fairly hard and gave it back and said that they just followed the UN charter. They had no idea of doing anything else. And it was handed back in 1975, which is a few years longer timeline than it's required, but they worked very hard. And part of that was some military defence, because the Indonesians were trying to send in probing forces, when I say probing forces, battalion size infantry into Papua New Guinea, which meant, this is all unknown. This is the story as it's told. And a lot of the place there was unmapped, and the Australian Army Mapping Corps would go up there to map out the villages. And there's various stories about the helicopters coming in and dropping people and people walking up. Very much so, there was the same first white contact. So there's a difference between contact where the information of the rest of the world filters in, so that filtered into everyone. Everyone knew various things, but this is the first time they'd seen all of these things. And tents, so the Mapping Corps would come in and they'd go into tents, and they'd have a crap in the ground, a hole crap in the ground, and the natives would, or the Papua New Guinea people would come and dig up their poo and have a look at it, you know, trying to understand it and watch them eat. And essentially, whatever they do, they'd have a little audience of between 10 and 50 people looking at them all the time. And this person came up out of his tent in the morning, and they would watch him brush his teeth. And he was someone who had a missing front tooth, but this time he had a plate, so he could actually so he got out of his tent and moved his front tooth on his plate, and all the Papua New Guinea natives were very fascinated by it, and the next day this person was outside his scratching outside his tent, and he showed him his bloody mouth, and he'd pulled out an actual tooth. And so this is a story, and you might hear it. There's various, you know, lots of weird, can't say, some weird, some unbelievable stories, this is one of the stories that have sort of been handed down around the place. It's not an official story, but it's sort of got a new resonance, in that this pulling out of the teeth, is just sort of like this most, imagine the pain of pulling out a tooth. I just can't, the whole story, it's just insane. So there were two things. The other thing about the Museum of Sydney was, in the Depression, the newspaper had a Great Depression. So the Great Depression in Australia was nearly as bad and sometimes worse than the Great Depression in America.
Yeah.
And the reason for it was that a lot of investment capital was in Australia and people were making money out of Australia, but this Great Depression hit and Australia was reasonably immune to it. However, they had these huge, you know, the mother country's in trouble, and they raise money, scrape money, and money was actually sucked out of the Australian economy and sent, repatriated to Britain, okay? So I don't know how that operated. And so this is the worst sort of Keynesian, if the Keynesian levers of financial knowledge, it was just automatically the mother country needs us and everything was in reverse. And so it's really sunk into depression. And what they did is set up competition in the newspapers for if you could snap people in the street. And what this did was it set up a film studio because people didn't at this stage have cameras. And so all throughout Sydney, people began photographing people. And then they realized they could make money by taking the photographs and saying, if you come back a day later, you'll be able to see a photograph. So in almost every street corner in Sydney would be someone hassling people to take photographs. And they would specialize in taking these photographs. And so as you can imagine, there was heaps, absolutely heaps and heaps of photographs. So Sydney became the most photographed. The people of Sydney became most photographed, and it was thought that by the rate of photography happening, that there was not one person in New South Wales who wasn't photographed during this time. And so they were all stylized photographs of, there was still, from the newspaper, the marking system came around, and so the photographer with the highest marks got a lot of business, and so you had your professional studios who had the bricks and mortars, and you had these fly-by-nights who, with their cameras, would be photographing everyone. So you can imagine, you know the story is that there's this fantastic museum exhibit where they are showing some of the best photographs of time, and a family which has been photographed pretty much every year. You can see them evolve and live, and this caught Australians suddenly going to war, and so in World War One, pretty much every single able-bodied Australian male went to World War One, and that really basically could be spared. And so I think it's 100,000, half a million Australians over in Europe, and 100,000, up around there, 100,000 casualties. So we were turned out to be the British, well, we fashion ourselves as British shock troops. But we were just the ones who were just dumb enough and gullible to keep on fighting when everyone else was giving up. I don't know the story there. But that was World War One. This is before, this is the start of World War Two. And you suddenly see people in different military uniforms and stuff like that getting ready in the fashions there. And, it was, important that everyone smiled. So you got this really sort of happy feeling, and women coming out of shops, and obviously the women coming out of shops, they would be carrying their purchases, and so it gave this fantastic exhibition of it, and it was sort of similar to the established licensed people and the unlicensed people, similar to the taxis and Uber a bit of that to come along and look at this middle of the night. This is Saturday, the middle of the night. Saturday night, and there's a man with a leaf blower. How does it go along? So we've got the visitors information centre here up in Glenbrook. It's beyond me what is going on. This is, what time of night? This is 10:30 at night. Now, what would be is that this person would have a contract to do so much leaf blow, so much cleaning, and he would have had a commitment during the day that's coming at night, and there'd be restrictions on what he could do. No such restriction here because it's out in the middle of nowhere, but he wouldn't be able to do his contract work at schools, making this noise at night. It's pretty amazing, amazing to see. There's these absolutely, they're just so engaging, the photographs, because it would be a certain category and you just see, what, 3 by 5, 15, no, it was something like 5 by 7, something, well, a lot of photographs, but of the same theme, like two women together, or family together, or children together, or young lovers together, or stuff like that, and it just, by seeing it, it just was just an incredibly powerful thing to go. Now, what actually happened here in this exhibition, or the story, was that people with established photography studios, photography studios, would really complain, and what would happen is that in order to remind people where to go, they'd give them the little tickets, and the people who weren't interested would throw them on the ground, and the city was able to nab these people because they could find people for, so this is a slightly strange thing, like in Australian law, that you could find someone, if there's a lot of litter and it's from this one person, it didn't matter who dropped it. The actual person who produced the litter had to actually pay for it. And so this is one of the things that they were threatening McDonald's with here. Well, the McDonald's thing, they're saying, all right, we're going to fine you, McDonald's. I don't think it ever happened because McDonald's was full of American lawyers and said, oh, la, la, la. But at this stage, they managed to try and shut this group down. But it persisted right up to when people got their own cameras. And now people take selfies all the time, and the world is littered with it. It didn't have the artistic, I don't know, this beautiful black and white. So there were these two exhibitions in the Museum of Sydney. I'm feeling a lot better. So last night when I did this round, it was really tough on me, about feeling better. I can actually feel, I'm still carrying these 2-3 kilogram weights here. So I'll quickly go over getting around in Sydney. So we pulled in we came from the mountains down through Parramatta, and another piece of information I found out was that the problem of why people moved inland is that the soil around Sydney Harbour, is really rubbish. And so the fertile soil where they could grow crops was further up the river around Parramatta, so they removed Parramatta. So if you can imagine the mountains where I am, 50% of the way is Parramatta, and then that creek opens up into fabulous Sydney Harbour. Now, we went in a little bit past Parramatta and got the train in to Central Station. Said goodbye to our daughter on a bus, and then proceeded to walk from Central Station probably no more than 4 kilometres at most. It would have to be probably 3 kilometres down George Street, which is the central street. Now, Sydney, a lot of Sydney is turning into walkways and they're putting in trams, so it should make it a nice city on the way. So we walked all the way up through there and stopped in the Victorian era department store, which is called the Queen Victoria Building, built obviously in the 18-something rather than the reign of Queen, g'day, in the reign of Queen Victoria. These people going, am I absolutely stuck grabbing that? And the answer is yes, I am. So in the age of Queen Victoria, something I've got a couple of days to go before I can go up to 5 kilogram weights. I can't, these weights are quite hard. Okay, so I suppose the interesting thing for me is the conversion of George Street into a pedestrian walk, which is fantastic. They're doing the right thing, getting rid of cars. I really wonder what driverless cars is going to do. They're putting massive money into public transport, new train lines, and this new line, and they're getting the bus, the tram stops. Now, it's very interesting in terms of the tram stops built in different, so there's trams and public transport going in really right throughout Australia, and the design of the tram stop I found exceptionally interesting, and it's simple, flat shapes, but not with concrete, not the feeling of concrete, it's with this polished copper colour, and it's such a brilliant thing, because it's got the red sort of earthy coppery colour of Australia, and it's got the reflection to reflect the seat shape, but it's not a glassy reflection, so it's not an internationalist style. It's just perfect. I just, how they do it, so it's quite exciting to see. And going up, we stopped at Hobbycombe. So in this building you go into, there's a chocolate shop and these, really nice restaurants, and hopefully I'll be able to tell you about the nice restaurant we went to for lunch. It's very reasonable with a fantastic view. You can see the Sydney Harbour Bridge, Circular Quay, the Opera House, and it was all cheap tucker. Oh, it was beautiful. I just can't describe how great it was. However, we went up to this Hobbycombe and began to see things which absolutely blew my mind. One is a mobile phone enabled drone for $50, under $50, is one thing. Then also a new digital scale electric set. This is, and it costs a fair packet, mind you, around $800 Australian, but it's sort of a fairly standard 3 meter scale electric set, and difference with it is that that the cars, it's traditionally it's one control per track, and you control the voltage on the track. This is a bit different. The voltage is set, but you radio control the amount of energy going to your set. So you can have, in this case, you can have 6 cars where you normally had 2. And so you've got 6 controllers. And obviously, the problem with this is that this requires a group thing. So this is something for a school, a group of people to play. We had sufficient people together. It's not, unfortunately, designed for a for a bedroom for two people to come along. So that was just a wake up, a wake up call. So I thought that was fantastic. There was a whole heap of things I saw in this toy shop, which were just revelationary. I've forgotten what it's called. The kinetic. I've forgotten the name of the. It's not Lego. It's sort of similar to Lego, but kinetics. I've forgotten what the name is called. But to see how they have some of the plastic design wear. So I've sort of really adopted Lego as a basic, easy to order tool. But there's these new. Plastic designs, which are just much better. These flexible tracks, I thought it was fantastic. I'm just really racking my brain to see some of the fantastic stuff that you see coming out in the toy stores, and sort of understanding, you know, how that goes and how that goes into kids' heads. Now I'm coming home. At the moment, I'm just really racking my head. So this is, if you're in Sydney, this is probably worth going to. It's Hobby Co. So it's over two floors, and yeah, in terms of just seeing how the electronics and the laser cutting and the Lego and the construction goes together, and how kids are thinking. And, you know, how they're playing. Obviously, everything's pretty expensive. I'm just lifting these weights up. Oh, how's it going across? That was before we hit the Sydney Museum. And after the Sydney Museum, we went to, I think it's the old Sailors Hospital, which has been turned into a modern art museum, and the story here is that the Second Fleet cost cut the Second Fleet, and so the Second Fleet arrived where everyone was basically half dead, and they basically had to build a hospital right away for these people. The colony was in distress, and these people just landed in. And so on the grounds of this was a maritime hospital that you can imagine, that also you sort of had diseased people coming in to Sydney Harbour, so you often had to have a hospital right there in the early days. And but we went in there, and at the front was a restaurant, and my son, who was a bit distressed, said, "Oh, we're going here, you know." I sort of asked, and they pointed, and you went inside, and you went up to the fourth floor, and on this roof was a really fantastic restaurant. But it was not your restaurant. Oh, sir, you know, it's table service. So it was a bit of a table service, but you had, it was sort of like a cross. It was sort of like a leagues club format, where you got the menu, then you went up and you ordered at the cashier, and then the cashier gave you a table number, and then they brought the food out to you. We're just coming into it. Now, this was a little bit interesting. Again, back onto the food thing, is that you had the, so the food was divided into two groups on this sort of plastic sheet. One on the left was your traditional early starters, sandwiches, two sort of traditional burger and kangaroo meat and stuff like that. And then on the right, they said, "Oh, this is a menu which is designed to go with our exhibitions. and it's designed to do, the menu is designed to do all these things. We've designed this menu to reduce the amount of waste and be sustainable. Oh, you have a look through it. It's a little bit, something a bit hard to read because it wasn't over the top. It would just have a few words and then some of the ingredients. And so my son ordered, I think it was for $9, which is, you know, very reasonable right on the circular quay. And it was a bun, had a poached egg, and right, had some cabbage and cheese in it. This is, yeah, it was fantastic. And then I had a bowl which had a poached egg in it, some heated corn, some other things I really didn't recognise, but tasted really fantastic. I just got to remember what my wife had, but it was just really interesting. And the serves were not American size, sort of, they were just normal size serves. So it was just really interesting in terms of that. This is really the first time I've seen it, where the thing was, you're paying so much that you have a very big serve of everything, and it's all, you know, meat oriented. I think she had a vegan delight, and I stuff like that, and it was just really super nice. And this is in May, and I don't know if the heat was. It was actually quite hot. I had my sort of warm jacket in the back, had to be put in the backpack, because my son said that I couldn't have it over my shoulder. I said, why? You saw the photographs of the people with it over the shoulder. And indeed, I was still having the hat and the dress and thinking of the people in that art exhibition, yet the world had well changed. I looked around, and indeed no one else was walking around with a, carrying a coat, their hands up and their coat slung over their shoulder. It was quite hot, and you could look out and see Sydney Harbour. It was quite good, and there was actually, just to make it interesting, so you know that I looked at the tall ships. There was a tall ship in the international terminal. So normally there is a Sydney Harbour, the cove, their Sydney Cove or Circular Quay. They have these mega ships which are 7 stories tall. The size of a city block comes in there, and it sort of basically almost swamps the entire tower there. And so it was gone, and there it was back to a bus. Sorry, not a bus, when I say a bus, a tall ship. And this time, for some reason, as my cognitive things came back, I could see the structure of the mast. And the mast is a mast up to a certain height, and then another higher section with the cross things is bolted on, so this bolting on section. And that was a sort of very, for me, a very poetic thing, having seen the Sydney Museum. So I've now walked around, and hopefully that's given you a little bit of a feel. You've walked with me as I've been there and sort of journeyed with me in my own focus of finding facts and just having a pretty unstructured frolic in history, and letting it flood through you, and you sort of connect but also disconnect. So a couple of people I spoke to had the same feelings, the same thoughts, but so in general, people are in their own little world. Thanks a lot for listening.
podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.